Animal.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montalgo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montalgo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have a fascinating topic. But before we jump off, we've got our usual little tidbits to announce. For tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience with your questions and comments. So please send them to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. You don't need to worry if I'm going to give your email or address or your name out over the air, and I'm not going to spam you either. I just don't have time for any of that. So, don't be shy. I know you have something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. Now, tonight's guest is Bonnie Jones Reynolds, a woman who is very busy and has a lot going on, but still has been gracious enough to join us for tonight's program. Bonnie, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience, as well as give them more information about some of the topics tonight?
Okay, well, I wear several hats. I'm a writer, an author, and my books can be found on Amazon. They can also be found at my own website, BonnieJonesReynolds.com. And then I am the co-founder and CEO of Spring Farm Cares. It's an animal sanctuary in upstate New York. That can be found at springfarmcares.org. And just lately, in the last year, I have become the writer and publisher of a 24-page, at this point, tabloid newspaper called The Flowback, which is a very, very good educational piece on hydrofracking. For the last 2 years, I have been very much involved in the anti-hydrofracking movement here in New York and throughout the country. And anyone who wants to talk to me about that can email me at bonnie@hydro.org. And basically, that's it. I suppose that we might be touching on all three of those topics tonight during our 2-hour rant and rave together, Gia.
Yeah. I have to admit, part of the reason you were on my hot list is I just had recently finished rereading your book, The Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I now live in Mississippi at the heart of the Bible Belt, and you know, the topic, the characters in the book are biblical characters. And I'm no Bible scholar, but I have to admit that fundamentalist-based religions really had very little appeal to me. I haven't been in a church I think the last time I was in a church was actually for my son's funeral. I mean, I just don't go to church.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not something that had much meaning for me on a day-to-day basis. So it was, you know, I'm kind of reading it from the, not an atheist, not a, just somebody who just really has very little time to spend on Christianity or any other religion in general. So that was sort of where I was coming from, you know, reading the book and everything. I still found it a book that had a lot to say, not only about perhaps religions, but about spirituality, about being a good person.
Uh-huh.
You know, it really did. And it brought the characters of the Bible sort of to life to me, for me. Even though it doesn't follow the Bible, you know, exactly.
In no way does it follow the Bible.
No. But, you know, it is the biblical characters, and it's bringing them to life in a way that made them seem much more real to me. And there was a lot said in that book about a lot of the things that many religions, at least, give lip service to. That's kind of been where, you know, my personal experience is, you know, there's a lot of lip service given, and then it falls down to the, and I'll kill you, and that'll change your mind.
Yeah, and if you don't believe me, I'll kill you.
Yeah. I find that a little frightening, you know. So for somebody who finds, you know, because I've actually been, I've actually had so-called religious people threaten me with bodily harm resulting in fatal consequences for me. I think the exact threat was, I'm going to take this shotgun and blow your head off.
Is that because of one of your shows?
No, actually, this is long before I started doing the radio. It's because I didn't believe the same as them.
Oh, I see.
You know, so therefore, you know, I really do have some issues with, you might say, fanaticism. And, you know, anybody who's dealt with a fanatic realizes that a fanatic will never change anybody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they really, they can't even promote their cause because they take it to such an extreme that there's no understanding, I guess. And you brought understanding to these characters without that, well, some of them did have a fanatic kind of thing. But you want to tell...
Joshua definitely did.
Yeah. You want to tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book, even? Because that was a monumental effort, okay? I know from reading it, that was a monumental effort.
To tell you the truth, I wrote it because I woke up one morning and I just had to write it. I didn't plan to write it. I began my research on it. I just woke up and had to do it. It just came boiling out of me. And as I say in the introduction, I don't really remember that. I remember doing the research. I remember pouring, in those days, we didn't have the internet that we have now, so in order to do your research, you had to crawl through libraries for days and days and days on end in order to get your information, or old secondhand bookshops where you find absolutely wonderful things. But I remember doing all of that. I remember doing a lot of the study to understand exactly where places were and what the situation was with roads in those days and blah, 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 blah. But any time that Mirovi, who is the Magdalene, or Josh, who other people would call Jesus, began to speak, I do not remember writing it. And when I read their words, when I sit there, like any first-time reader, I sit there and I say, Oh, my God, that is so beautiful. I cannot have written that. And no matter how many times, Gia, that I go back in and read this, I have not read the book through again for well over a year, but I keep it on my desk. And every once in a while, I'll just open it to a page and whatever it is that's bothering me, I'll find something there to soothe it or to answer the question or whatever. So I'm not saying that this book was channeled. I firmly believe, I'm a believer in reincarnation, I believe that I heard those words spoken. I believe I was there. I believe I heard what I put into that book. Mm-hmm. So that's Luke called the loony bin, right?
No. When I was reading it, it was like, you know, I can believe in, you know, this type of a concept much easier than I'm this fire and brimstone god that is often portrayed.
Well, as a matter of fact, you also met in the Magdalene, you met a character named Simon Yeshua. And at the time of when Jesus lived in Palestine, well, it was Palestine at that point, there were dozens of people. There was a turn of the millennium, and there was a Messiah fever in the air, and they were waiting for the Messiah to come, and there were a dozen guys running around the countryside claiming to be the Messiah.
Kind of like we've had for the last 20 years, right?
Right. So, there were the fire and brimstone guys. I believe, it's my belief, that in the what we call the New Testament, the life, the doings, the sayings of at least two different men were combined by later writers, put together to appear to be one person. And that is why there are so many people are always pointing out, you know, wait a minute, he says this here and someplace else he says something else. He says, put away your sword, Peter. And another place he says, I come to bring your sword. Well, I believe that you were listening there to two different people. And so in the book, my Josh is the one who is giving what I believe to be the true message that Jesus meant the world to have, whereas Simon Yeshua is the fire and brimstone fellow who, unfortunately, much of his, what he believed and felt and did, crept into the documents of the New Testament and messed up what Josh really wanted to say and give to the world.
Well, yeah, a lot of people are going to say that it's practical to bring these characters to life in a book. I disagree. And, you know, in addition...
Where is it written that we can't write about these people?
Oh, it absolutely isn't.
How well is that law made?
You know, there's a whole bunch of things that people think that, you know, isn't necessarily based on truth. I mean, once upon a time, everybody thought the world was flat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know...
It's not?
Yeah. Newsflash, it's not flat. We live on our globe. Sort of right.
And as the ice melts at the poles, of course, we're going to find that indentation at the top of the world that goes into the Middle Earth. You know, we're finally going to find that thing.
Yeah, surely.
Either that or the Middle Earth people are going to have to figure out another way to think about things.
Something. And, you know, and so a lot of things that people have thought have not been entirely based on truth, and we know that.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows, you know, 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now, how much of what we think to be true today is going to be proven to be absolutely ridiculous. You know, we know this is going to happen. But still we go on with our pompous, you know, it's that we know everything. It's the information age. And, you know, in reality, we don't know that much about our own planet, let alone what's outside of it. So we have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
to learn.
Well, things are coming to attention. You may or may not have heard about the papyrus, the little piece of papyrus.
I saw that.
Yes, that basically, it's now we don't know what context it was in, but Jesus said to them, "My wife," and then it's cut off. And he also talks about a woman named Mary being worthy of it, and a woman who will be able to be my disciple. Now, we can't run off half-cocked and be, insist that this proves that Jesus did have a wife, which he did, and her name was the Magdalene. But this does not necessarily prove it until we can know the context it was written in. It appears to be a tiny piece of a larger document that probably antiquity dealers, they took different pieces and sold it separately to make more money. And hopefully now the people who have the other pieces will realize that they can make themselves millions of dollars by coming forward with the other pieces, and then we can then understand more about this document and the context in which those little bits and pieces of statement were made.
I thought it was rather fortuitous that that particular piece hit the headlines, and I read about it while I was in the middle of reading Magdalene.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, that's kind of cool.
Okay, so we did have a wife.
Yeah, it was like, we can go with this is an omen, it's the truth, yeah. If we want to get really hoo-hoo. the thing is that this book has a lot to say, and a lot of it actually agrees with some discussions I've had with people who were very studied in theology and spirituality and whatnot. And, it didn't disagree with anything that they had to say.
It is very, very, I've got to say, it is very well researched. There is nothing, absolutely nothing in there that cannot be backed up by either historical sources or very solid suppositions from the sources.
So. Uh-huh. Yeah, so anybody who's out there listening, if you have any questions or anything that you want to put forward, send them in on my email. My email is gscott@exogenynetwork.com, and we'll get your questions to Bonnie. And even if you catch us on a podcast, go ahead and send them to me, and I'll forward them, and we'll see about getting you an answer. It's a great book. Pick it up, read it. It is available through Amazon. I'm sure your local books dealer could also order it for you. So, yeah, check it out. It's a good, good book. It's an excellent read, and it is, in so many ways, it's life-affirming. For anybody who's going through transitions in their own life or is facing difficulties, it can be not only a good read, but, boost your spirits, you might say. So, yeah, I definitely highly recommend it. Yep, and it was an excellent book. You have written other books, though.
Yeah. My first novel was called The Truth About Unicorns, and that was written back in 1972. It did make a couple of bestseller lists, actually it got republished, I think it was 2 years ago, what is it called, Something in Mayhem, Something in Mayhem Press, I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. It is available through Amazon, I know that.
It's a new paperback. Anybody who wants the hardback needs to get in touch with me, the original hardback I sell. But anybody who wants a paperback can get it off of Amazon. Yeah, and what is it? Something in Mayhem. It's not Torture in Mayhem. Crime in Mayhem or something like that, Press. But I was absolutely delighted to get a call from that publisher, a couple of you, and she said, I read that book when I was back, when it was first published 35 years ago, And I have never forgotten it, and I've decided that I would like to reprint it. So there it is. There was a second novel called The Confetti Man, and that is out of print at the moment. It can be gotten on Amazon through secondhand stores. I don't have it. Unfortunately, all of my copies were in the fire that I had several years ago, and I lost, you know, all of my possessions in that. So all of my copies of the Confetti Man are gone, although I do still have the Unicorn. Then I published, I wrote a book for my yoga teacher, Bikram Choudhury, the hot yoga man. And this has been in continuous print since 1978. It's called Bikram's Beginning Yoga Class. And then I wrote with my co-founder here at Spring Farm Cares. I wrote a book about Spring Farm Cares that's called If Only They Could the Miracles of Spring Farm, and then The Magdalene. So those are the five books that are available.
Okay. And for people who are looking for the book about the unicorn, it's Felony and Mayhem.
And Felony and Mayhem, right, right. I should know that from my own publisher.
That's okay. It's Felony and Mayhem. It was reprinted in 2010, and it's available through Amazon. It's 472 pages, according to Amazon, even.
How much?
So, 472 pages.
Oh, is it that much? Okay.
Small pages, I guess, you know. Well, in paperback format, it's that many pages. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, yeah, you've been writing that stuff, and do you have any new novels in the works? Or have you been too busy to do any of that?
Well, I have several that I'm toying with. I would truly love to do to continue The Magdalene. However, the research on that would be so absolutely gigantic that I'm just not sure whether I would have the time. Actually, what I'm working on are some a couple of nonfiction ideas at this point.
Okay.
And one of them is basically indicating that the only way out of the mess that we're in is to bring down the oil and gas industry.
Uh-huh.
We've got to get rid of carbon-based fuels. We have got to bring down the oil and gas industry. It's the only thing that's going to save us and save our planet, I believe.
Yeah, you know, when we look at alternative energy things, and I've done a lot of research on that here lately, you know, it's really daunting to the average person. I consider myself an average person. To contemplate, you know, I have lived off-grid. Most average people, I'll admit, have never lived off-grid. I lived way out in the boonies on a ranch in Arizona where the electric lines and the telephone lines stopped, you know, 20 miles before they got to our house. So you lived with, we had propane lights in the house,
mm-hmm.
propane stove, propane refrigerator, which is still oil-based, but at that time,
certainly not with the footprint that an ordinary house would have.
Right. Also, not the comfort, too, because central Arizona in the summertime gets like 110, 120
uh-huh.
degrees.
Yeah.
When you don't have any way to cool your house, you know, my method of dealing with it was you had to be out of the house by 8 a.m. Don't plan on going back in until sometime after 6 p.m. when
mm-hmm.
the temperature in the house dropped enough that you could physically tolerate it.
Yeah.
Midday, once I'd forgotten something and I had to go in, the house was probably between 130 and 150 degrees.
Oh, gosh.
This wasn't a well-built house, by the way. It was actually a mobile home that we lived in on the ranch. And you could literally watch your skin squirting out the sweat. I mean, you could not have tolerated being in there. I literally ran in, got what I wanted, and ran back out. It could have killed you probably in 5 minutes.
Wow.
I mean, it was incredibly hot.
Well, that's what happens during these heat we had, you know. Back in, I was about, 7, 8 years ago, in Europe. 33,000 people died in that heat wave. Most people don't know that. I know about it because I was there for the beginning of it. I was visiting friends in Bordeaux, a city in southern France, and it was so horrible that at night I would drag myself into the shower 3 or 4 times and then go and lie on the floor in front of the window gasping for air. And luckily, I only had to endure a couple of days of that before I came home. But 33,000 people died throughout Europe from the heat. And folks, that's the beginning of the end for any kind of life on this planet. Unfortunately, it's a possibility that's going to get worse and worse and worse.
Well, I now live in Mississippi, okay? I thought it got hot in Arizona. I was hot.
Yeah, but it's hot and damp in Mississippi, isn't it?
Yeah, when I first moved to the South, I originally lived in New Orleans, and I remember going in to sign the lease on the apartment. And, it was indoors in air conditioning, and the sweat was literally dripping off me. People stared at me. I must have looked like, I was... on some sort of drug problem or something, because I've sweated so profusely. But it was like my body was saying, it's hot, we're sweating, we're not cooling down, let's sweat some more. I remember actually asking a friend who had lived there their whole lives, I said, do people's hair, does it mildew here? I mean, my hair hadn't been dry in a month. I still sweat probably more than the average person, but I have very little tolerance for the heat. I've actually given up camping and stuff like that in the summertime. Mm-hmm. Until the nighttime temperatures are dropping down around 60. I don't even want to talk about going camping. And I used to be an avid camper. I go camping. Oh yeah, I want to go sleep in a tent. The last time I tried a summer camping trip, I slept in a hammock. I'd quit using the tents because it was just too hot. I mean, I couldn't even cope with that. So we had used a lean-to, and this particular time I'd heard a lot about hammocks, but I was just using, most hammock campers use a ripstop nylon hammocks. I was using a typical cotton hammock like you'd hang in your backyard. I thought that would be relatively comfortable. I was wrong. I just ended up with a sweaty hammock. and it was just too hot. I left a day early because I said, I can't do another night. I just can't. I'm too tired. I'm not dealing with the heat. And part of it is I do have health issues now that I didn't have 5 or 10 years ago, my tolerance for discomfort has dropped. And that's true of all older people, usually. You've got health issues that make dealing with heat much more difficult. I don't know how anybody lived in the South before air conditioning, to be honest. I really don't. Before air conditioning and refrigeration, those people were tough. And I know some of my ancestors lived in the South. So, it's like, whoa, they were tough. That's all I can say to it.
Yeah.
Because it really is. It's far different from living on the desert where it cools off at night.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't uncommon if you were at high enough altitude. It'll get down even in the 30s in midsummer at night. When the sun goes down, it cools off fast. Well, in the South, that's not true. So trying to think of ways, because I'm like most people, I don't want to pay more for my electricity than I have to, and trying to be a little greener and doing things like hanging out your laundry instead of throwing it all in the dryer. It's not as convenient in some ways, and in some ways maybe it's more convenient. But all these things that we do to try and reduce our own carbon footprint. So one of the things I'd explored was the alternative energy. And, the concept of other ways to cool your house, whether it's using wind generators or solar panels to...
We're looking into geothermal here.
I don't
heard of geothermal?
Geothermal, you tend to need areas, the more geologically active an area is, the more likely geothermal is to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Here, we don't even have rocks.
Uh-huh.
It's like we're living on a layer of jelly. It's not as bad. We just recently moved 100 miles from the coast, so it's not as bad as when we were living closer to the coast or in New Orleans. But a heavy truck, even half mile away going down the highway, would literally, you could feel it in the earth or in your house, because those ripples just spread out from anything. An earthquake would be, I can't even imagine, it would be like waves of jelly, just, you know, I forget the terminology for it, but it is that it does happen in earthquakes occasionally, where the earth turns to a semi-liquid state.
Plasma. I think they call it plasma.
Yeah, something like that. But it turns to a semi-liquid state, and it will actually envelop living creatures, objects, et cetera, et cetera. The earth doesn't really liquefy. It still remains a solid, but it moves as a liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thought of something like that happening is like, oh, yuck, what a horrible way to go, you know?
Yeah. Well, here at Spring Farm, we have, we've put up windmills. We have three residential-size windmills. They're each 130 feet tall. We have three of them. And Spring Farm Cares is a rather large organization. We have five main buildings. We have 30 employees. The three windmills take care of about 60% of our electricity bill.
Uh-huh.
So we're very pleased with that. I have friends who have done solar on their roof, the roofs of their house, their businesses. One of our town offices here has put solar on their roofs. And this is, by the way, this is upstate New York, you know, and so it doesn't matter, snow or not. These people haven't paid electric bills in several years now since they put the solar up on their roofs. So, it is there. It's expensive to install to start with, but do recoup the money by not having to pay your electricity bill after that.
Right. And for me, it was a case of trying to balance the cost effectiveness, too. We recently bought an older home, which needs renovating. We're in the middle of that. Nothing works quite right, you know, and things that were well planned have, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, you know, the saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll admit, nothing went smoothly about our move. I mean, absolutely nothing. If it could go wrong, it did go wrong.
Murphy's Law.
Oh, yeah. Murphy was having a heyday with that. Absolute heyday. We've now got almost everything in the same locale. We have a boat left to retrieve. However, we had a vehicle breakdown, and apparently the transmission's gone out in it. And, of course, it was the one that we didn't think needed repairs. The other one needs some repairs, but we're having to use it nonetheless because, you know, that one has a transmission issue. So it was poor planning part of Murphy in terms of our budget and time constraints and everything else, because Hurricane Isaac came in the middle of it. The week that we had actually intended to originally bring everything in the truck, Hurricane Isaac decided to come calling, and that, of course, sort of put the kibosh on it, and then we needed to wait until things were dried out enough that you dared drive a truck over lawn. Unfortunately, even after, I think we waited 3 weeks, it still wasn't quite dry enough.
Uh-huh.
But that could have been worse. The truck could have got stuck, and we would have had to get a tow truck for that, too.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm.
So not everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. But, you know, in terms of the renovation and stuff, obviously, you know, we're very interested in keeping our costs down. This, being an older home, does not have central air.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, okay, we can't live with it, you know, too terribly hot. But at the same time, you know, you've got to balance all your other things, your cost, your monthly cost, as well as your initial outlay. Right now, we went with a Energy Star window unit simply because that seemed to be the only option to get installed now.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we install central air or not is sort of up in the air. We really haven't explored that. We've been dealing with more urgent repairs, you might say.
Yeah.
But the options of solar panels and stuff do exist. We have a number of very large trees surrounding our house, pecan trees and live oaks. So that, you know, is also a concern about whether they would shade them.
Well, no, you can do an array. It can be a freestanding array of panels that can be put out in a sunny place, and then wires come to the house.
Uh-huh.
That can be done. It doesn't have to be right on your house.
In our case, it might be better to put it on the house because that might be the sunniest place in the yard. They are very large trees, and it's not a very large yard. So we honestly don't have, even looking for garden space, it's like, oh, we have this little patch here and that little patch there, and that's it. Everything mm-hmm. else is shaded most of the day. The top of the house, portions of it, are probably the least likely. The house isn't actually as bad as some of the ones that we looked at. Without air conditioning, when the outside temperature was in the mid-90s, it was probably 5 to 10 degrees cooler in the house.
Mm-hmm. And well, those trees ought to help.
Yeah, 5 to 10 degrees cooler in the house with it all shut up and nothing running for weeks, months. That's still cooler than many of the houses we were in. It was 10 to 20 degrees hotter inside the house than it was outside.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we were looking at houses, that was part of the things that we compared was what did it actually feel like when you walked in? Was it hotter? Was it cooler? You know, about the same temperature? What? And since we were house hunting in midsummer, we were looking for cooler than outdoors versus warmer than outdoors. So hopefully we got a house that is, well, from what we had checked out and everything, it is well built. But hopefully it will not prove to be difficult to keep the climate controlled indoors. So, you know, in terms of your animal rescue group, I didn't realize it was that large, actually.
Yes,
what kind of rescue stuff do you do there?
Well, we've got about 30 horses, ponies, donkeys. There are sheep and goats. We used to have llamas. Unfortunately, my llamas died of old age. Various poultry. At the moment, there are probably at least 175 cats and kittens. This is during kitten season. Dogs, rabbits, birds. We take in whatever domestic or pet animals happen to come our way. That is, we take them in as long as we have room. We are a no-kill facility. We don't, you know, put them to sleep at the back door in order to be able to take them in at the front door. Not only that, animals that come to us, if they are unadoptable for whatever reason, they live with us for life. And we take care of them and give them a good home for life. So, we take in what we can as we're able. Yesterday we took in 4 more kittens and a duck.
So. 4 kittens and a duck, uh-huh. Yeah. My daughter recently adopted a miniature pony. He happens to be a little stallion. And he has proven to be an escape artist because neighbors have mares who happen to be in heat. And he can jump higher than he is tall. He resorted to jumping fences when he could no longer bash gates open. So as they've been fixing things, he's become more creative at evading them.
Have you thought about neutering our little fellow there?
I had said that that might be what the best solution, the most cost-effective solution might be, was simply take him to the vets. He's a very, very, I was surprised because, yes, I'd worked with horses. However, I had nearly a phobia about dealing with stallions, and I had really bad experiences with some proud cut geldings over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And for anybody who doesn't know, it's like they're gelded, but they don't know that they've been neutered.
Yeah, right.
And so they behave like a stallion, and some of them can become aggressive, and that was the ones I had encountered. Because I had mares. Anyhow, the whole gelding and stallion thing, just I had mares. It was just easier. So anyhow, the little stallion had made his first escape. I happened to be at their house. It was right after Hurricane Isaac had passed through, and he had escaped apparently at the crack of dawn. And so the neighbor who we had gone to visit, her owner had brought my daughter's little boy home. And he loves children. He absolutely adores kids. He couldn't get near the little pony, but his daughter, who looked like she was 8-10 years old, he kept right up to her. And then we get him back in, and he decides he's going to try bashing through the side of the fence, and I didn't want him to figure out that he might be able to stretch the chain link, and I just walked up and whacked him on the butt, and I thought to myself, you know, if anybody had ever told me that I would dare do that with a stallion who was in frenzy at this point, I mean, he was really in a frenzy, because that mare was just really getting to him, and I wouldn't have believed it, because he is incredibly docile. I have to admit, he's a pretty nice little pony. You can handle him real easy and whatnot. And I really had not been around ponies since I was a kid, so I didn't have, when my kids were young, I didn't have ponies. We had regular horses. So, you know, I remembered the sour-tempered ponies I dealt with as a children. I wasn't real enthusiastic when she told me about this pony that was coming to live with her, and it was primarily because he had a history of escape artist tactics, and she thought she could contain him. I think she's going to have to become more creative, or he's going to make a trip to the vet.
Well, yeah, it's kinder to him too, because just think of the stress and the tension and the anxiety, you know, the he's enduring all the time. Not being able to get to those females. I mean, it's not pleasant for him to live in that kind of situation.
Yeah, I had also suggested maybe they should get him a buddy. Horses are social. They're like dogs, only more so in a lot of ways, because they're herd animals. And he's by himself now, because she doesn't have any other horses, and he might be happier if he had a buddy, because...
Well, what, are you going to get another stallion, or a gelding, or what are you going to get?
I have no idea, because, you know, they're not my ponies, I don't live there.
Yeah.
I just suggested this might be something to make him happier, simply, you know, get him a buddy.
Because if it's another stallion, they're going to fight over the females that both of them are sensing and trying to get to. If it's a gelding, he's liable to start trying to make love to the gelding. If it's a female, you know what's going to happen.
11 months from then, they'll have another pony. Geldings are not always friendly to stallions that are not from their same little group, too, because our little Don Juan nearly got damaged by the gelding that was always with the mares, and he was not happy about, you know, Mr. Don Juan coming calling. So, you know, unless they're together and they know each other, you know, it's I guess it could be interesting. Now, I did have a question coming in about someone who their neighbor has a dog that they're abusing, and they said that it has mushrooms growing on its back, and what should they do? I guess my response is call your local animal protection group, whether it's animal control or somebody else. You have any? I've never heard of mushrooms going on a dog's back.
That's pretty bad. The animal definitely has to see a vet. The trouble is, Gia, that I mean, even around here, some communities do not have animal control officers. They do not have even police who are willing to go in. But yes, you're right. Get in touch with your local Humane Society, ASPCA, the nearest one that you can find. If you can get pictures of the situation, photos of the situation, without getting yourself, belongs to a neighbor? If you can sneak in there and get pictures of it without trespassing or getting yourself shot by the neighbor. Otherwise, just try to get the authorities in, because that's absolute animal abuse. Again, throughout the country, the laws governing the care of animals are different from community to community, state to state, county to county. Generally, the animal control laws will say that if there's something wrong with your animal, it is incumbent on the owner to get vet attention for them. I've heard of mushrooms growing on the back. That is an awful lot of dirt that has accumulated on that animal, and spores have somehow gotten into the dirt and are growing. That's grotesque.
Yeah, I have never heard of such a thing. I've worked with animal rescue a long time, periodically. I haven't here in the last couple of years.
Tell that person if they want to, send their email to information@springfarmcares.org. Springfarmcares with an S, all one word, .org, and address it to Dawn. And she's my co-founder.
Okay.
And when we know more about the situation, we can give better advice on what to do about the situation.
Okay. All right. Listener, if you're out there, send that in, and get in touch with Dawn and see what can be done to help that poor dog, because that sounds like a dire situation, actually.
Yeah.
And animal rescue can be very heartwarming. It can also be very, very sad. Now, I know that when I moved to Mississippi, initially I lived along the coast, and riding bicycle, going for walks, walking my dogs, anything like that, man, I was continually plagued with loose and at least aggressive sounding dogs. I don't know if they were really aggressive or not.
You don't want to take the chance.
No. It happens, even though I've worked with dogs my entire life, because I used to show dogs, train dogs, I've had dogs, the whole business. The one time I am afraid of a dog is when I'm on a bicycle, because I had an accident where a dog attacked me on a bicycle. It caused me a lot of expense and injury and pain. And I'll admit, any time a dog comes snarling after me when I'm on a bicycle, my heart stops, okay? I freeze because I don't know what to do. Are they going to hit me and knock me down and attack me? What are they going to do? Now, we've recently moved, and I've noticed there are no feral cats, no wandering cats. I've not seen a cat or a dog, unless it's been on leash, at all. And I had neighbors tell me that, don't ever let your dogs get loose because they'll get picked up. I don't know if they're, rapidly put to sleep and you don't get a chance to retrieve them. I don't know what the story is. I haven't lived here long enough to even contemplate that occurring. We don't have a fenced yard, and So right now we've been using tie-outs with our dogs. Our dogs, all three of them, are old, and our cats are house cats. But I'll admit, my neutered male cat seems to think that getting outside is a good thing. And mm-hmm. so he will always try to get out the door, always try for an escape route. You know, so I'm a little afraid of that. So I'm going to have to explore exactly what the local policies are. Because even though I don't let my dogs run loose and I don't want them to get loose, I've had it happen. You know, they escape mm-hmm. sometimes. Yeah. You drop a leash or you stumble or they dart out the door unexpectedly. Our boy, we only have the one boy dog, is fairly recent. He's been with us just a little over a year. And he was a chihuahua that was dumped off in a rural neighborhood where my daughter lives. And how anybody could dump a 5-pound dog on a road and drive away, I don't know.
We've had it happen dozens of times. They've been brought in to us by people who found them beside the road just standing there quivering.
Yeah, this poor little guy was very skinny, covered in ticks and fleas, and I don't think he'd been out all that long, but I really kind of felt bad for him. We needed a third dog, about like I need a third eye, but okay.
Well, a third eye, according to the Eastern mystics, is a fine thing to have, and actually, supposedly, we all have one, so...
Yeah, well, this is true, but I really did need the third dog. I didn't tell me 100 reasons why I couldn't afford one. And after the vet trip this year, I almost had to agree that I can't really afford him, but I can't afford a lot of things that I like. So, yeah. So he joined us, and he's our most recent joinee. Sissy, my feist, came to me sight unseen. Actually, I was told she was a rat terrier, 6 months old. I was expecting a 10-12 pound dog. I got a dog that had been spayed over a year before, but the documentation I was given, she'd been spayed over a year before. She'd been through 3 rescue groups and adoptions. And had ended up on death row in a dog pound again. And she was a 25-pound feist. So she wasn't accurately portrayed. And she actually acquired her name because she came to me with the name Lovey. And I said, there is no way I'm standing on my back porch hollering, "Here, Lovey, here, Lovey." It's just not happening. So... she didn't have a name, and I fostered dogs at the time, and my oldest dog is a big girl, and she was really good at taking these young, they're usually about a year old, have no manners, usually don't even know their name, they're not housebroken, they've been in somebody's backyard till they got tired of the mess, and then they got rid of them. And I would end up fostering that kind of dog, because she was really good at breaking off things like continual nuisance barking and whatnot. And she did it just like a mama dog, because, see, as a queen of the universe, every time they bark, she has to go investigate. Well, if it's nothing, just like a mama dog, even though she's never had puppies, she would throw them down and kind of maul on them a little bit, and then go back to her post in the center of the yard. Well, you know, when it was something, she would join in on the barking. So they were in about 3 days, the nuisance barking stopped.
Mm-hmm.
If there was something to bark at, yes, they would bark. But if there wasn't, Red would have mauled them on the ground and taught them not to do that.
If you don't have something to say, kid, don't open your mouth, right?
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, she was good at it. And she doesn't have the patience for it anymore. She's much older now. Anyhow, when these big ones would get to bouncing around, Sissy would yelp like somebody was killing her, and nobody had even touched her, gotten even close to her. You know, the other dogs are kind of ignoring her because she's just standing around curling her lip up about everything. And I would tell her, "Don't be such a sissy. Go play," you know. And the name stuck. Now, Sissy has issues. Many people told me I'm nuts to keep her. If she gets ticked off at you, she will go pee or poo on your bed and the guest room bed. And that's not real endearing, so she's not allowed free reign of the house. She has to be supervised because you never know what's going to tick her off. Telling her no is enough, or not giving her a cookie or whatever. She's very cat-like in that, and she doesn't like other dogs, and she doesn't like anybody, and she thinks my granddaughter, who's going on 2, is certainly the devil incarnate. So she's never allowed around children. kind of has a restricted life, but, and she's losing her vision. So I think that's part of the reason that everything has become monsters for her. We adapt to her, and we simply, when we have guests or whatnot, we just have to keep her away because, A, she's never going to shut up. She will bark continuously. And, B, you can't have her around any other dogs, or not even Red, or anything anymore, because she decided years ago she wanted to be Queen Bee, and she was going to continuously attack and try to whoop the other dogs, even though they're 3 times her size, and she always got hurt. The last vet bill was astronomical at an emergency vet, so that's when I said no more. We're going to have a segregated household. I can't deal with this anymore. So we live with her idiosyncrasies and unknown AIDS, and people tell me I'm crazy. But it is now time for us to take a break. So while we are away from your computer, check out the websites that Bonnie has mentioned and take a look at the reviews about her books. They've got some good ones up on Amazon. And we will be right back to talk about not only animal rescue, but we're going to be talking about fracking in the second hour.
Okay.
You can join us each Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
We're a parapsychic radio show that isn't afraid to push the limits.
We have limits?
Well, if we do, we haven't found them yet.
Chris is the godfather of psychic mediums, and he'll give you a reading you can't refuse.
You better believe it. And Stephanie is the co-hostess with the mostest.
Relax there, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Second Sight NYC is the show that even the spirits listen to.
How can you make such a claim?
Well, the spirits told me. Give us 2 hours to open your minds to the possibilities of what could be.
This show is all about what is seen and unseen, known and unknown, and everything in between.
Each week, we make the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the sky, wondering if there's something out there
in fear of things going bump in the night?
This show brings you head first into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts,
UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Breaking news! Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth! People are exhilarated! And scared! Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down! My God! My God! They're beaming me up with them! Don't put that probe there! Don't put that probe there! Don't put a...
Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchard, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
My name is James O'Connell, and I'm the founder of the Experiencers Alien Encounter Research Team. And yes, my extraterrestrial visitors told me to seek out others like myself and then look within. So we know they've left clues for us to unlock. Each experiencer may have a piece of this cosmic puzzle hidden in their subconscious memories, and this information is leading us on a scavenger hunt for the answers to this extraterrestrial phenomenon. Come along with us as we examine the lives of ordinary people that are involved in extraordinary circumstances. Expect to experience the mystical, magical, and miraculous, because where our team goes, alien encounters follow. This amazing journey begins with us, because we are the Experiencers Alien Encounter Research Team from the John Mack Institute.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montalgo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Bonnie Joan Reynolds. And Bonnie, before we get started, are there some websites that you would like to remind people to take a moment and look at while they're listening to the program tonight?
Sure. If people want to see about any of my books, they can find out about them on my private website, BonnieJonesReynolds.com. They can also get on to Amazon. They're sold on Amazon, and there's some good reviews there. As far as Spring Farm Cares, the animal sanctuary of which I'm the co-founder and CEO, that is the website is Spring Farm Cares, all one word, .org, and that's a wonderful website. My partner Dawn does that. She's my co-founder here, and she does the website, and she does a fabulous job for people that love animals. She gets some really, really good animal stories on there. And to get in touch with me about anything, well, about the hydrofracking, Bonnie at Hydro Relief, all one word, HYDRORELIEF.org. And that's how to get in touch with me about the flowback or any other matters that you want to get in touch with me about.
Okay. Now, you know, in the second portion, I thought we'd go into the hydrofracking and the flowback. First of all, let's start off with why you started publishing the flowback.
Well, it was about 2 years ago. We here at Spring Farm, like everybody else, were falling for the natural gas industry line of this wonderful clean fuel. And we even, I am horrified to say, even changed over from oil to natural gas to heat Spring Farm and to cool Spring Farm. But shortly after that, I began to get an inkling of how absolutely disastrous this whole hydrofracking, long-line hydrofracking business is. I made it my business to really research it, and I spent weeks and weeks. And with the blessings of our board of directors, I basically began to work full-time on trying to keep it out of New York State because we realized we're on one of the main north-south routes through New York State, Route 12. And it goes from Binghamton up to Watertown, up to the, you know, to the St. Lawrence River. And the traffic on this road is already pretty bad. And all of a sudden we're looking, and the farmers all around us are leasing their land for hydrofracking, for these gas wells. And we began to realize that if this thing came in and the road in front of Spring Farm became 24/7/365 truck traffic, and with the attendant diesel fumes, and if our water and air got poisoned here, we would have to close our doors and move out of the state and find a place for shale gas extraction being planned. And we were not very happy about this. We loved Spring Farm. I love it. It's been in my family since 1820. I'm the sixth generation here on the farm. And to walk away from this would be walking away from my heart and soul. And so the last 2 years, I have been working almost full-time on understanding the situation and on fighting its entry into New York State. And one night I was going to a town board meeting, and in other towns, and I participated in a movement that has gotten bans and moratoriums in more than 140 townships and villages throughout New York State. So I happened to be at a township meeting in another county, and a guy stood up and started talking about hydrofracking, and when I left, I handed him my business card. And he called the next day, and he said, okay. He said, I happen to be, my business is producing these very, very high-class tabloids, and I think that we ought to get together and do a tabloid, an educational tabloid, on hydrofracking. So that was the beginning of it. We worked for several months getting the first issue together. At this point, there are over 150,000 of them in circulation, and they're being asked for every place from Michigan and West Virginia all the way through Ohio and all of the Northeast states. I encourage anybody who really wants to understand the issues regarding hydrofracking to get in touch with me at hydrorelief.org, and I'll see that you get a copy of the flowback. And the more people that we have that read the flowback, the more chance we have of stopping this thing. The hydrofracking issue is, along with the climate crisis, it's part and parcel of the climate crisis because of the release of methane. But it is so important. The hydrofracking, if it's turned loose completely on the, we won't have any clean water left. We won't have anything left. It has the potential to completely destroy most of our country and most of the world. There are maps in the flowback that show the places they're planning to frack throughout the world. That they're going to destroy all the clean water in the world. I mean, we can get along, believe it or not, without carbon-based fuels, without oil, and without gas. We can't live for more than a day without water. We've got to have water. And this thing has the potential to destroy that thing, not only the water, but the air. 100% of the time, this process releases ground-level ozone that is disastrous to human lungs and animal lungs, and to the trees. I mean, it's disastrous to everything around it. It's flowback, that the hydrofracking is one complete and total catastrophe. And we have to help people understand that. And only if enough people understand it can do we have a chance of stopping it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've got a copy of this tabloid paper right in front of me, the flowback. And, you know, it's very well done, and it has a lot of information in it. You know, a lot of people don't realize exactly what hydrofracking can do. And I'll admit, when I did the first program about it a couple months ago, you know, I'd heard the term and I had sort of a really vague idea, but I didn't know that much about fracking.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, you know, I know I'm going to talk to some people who are against fracking. Let's talk to somebody who worked in the industry. So I called someone that had worked in the industry for the last probably 40 years or so, and I said, okay, tell me about fracking. So, you know, he describes what fracking is, and he says when it's done right, it's safe, but the butt is usually what gets
Murphy's Law.
He told about a case in his own neighborhood just down the road from him. They had done some fracking, not on this guy's property. It was on a neighboring property. And he got up the next morning. I'm thinking he turned on the stove and then went to run water or something like that.
Oh, my God.
There was
God.
A source of flame, and he turned on the water faucet. Natural gas came out of the faucet because it had been forced into his water well, and his pump system had picked it up. There was a very large explosion. No, he was not. He was not killed or apparently severely injured. He just had relatively minor injuries. And financially, he came out of the situation well, because the company paid him very well, shut up, and replaced his lost property.
They're non-disclosure agreements. The people that get paid, no, seriously, they're made to sign non-disclosure agreements. They get paid off, but they can't talk to anybody. They can't tell anybody anything.
This happened a number of years ago, 20 years or more ago. Okay, This happened to be in New Mexico. So, you know, even when things are supposed to be done one way, we've seen where they don't happen that way. That's how we ended up with the deep water oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico, which that's still...
It wasn't an oil leak. That was a gas leak. Deep Water Horizon was a methane leak. That's what exploded.
And we ended up with a lot of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. And living on the coast, that
they're not letting people know. They're keeping under wraps all the animal deaths, all of the dolphin deaths, all of the animals that are dying there, the aquatic animals that are dying as a result of this whole thing. It was a catastrophe, and it was because of methane. It was a methane leak.
And it's not over yet. I mean, it's going to be decades before that resolves itself in the Gulf of Mexico. That was a huge disaster, but on scales, a lot of these hydrofracking incidents have some pretty severe repercussions too in their immediate areas, and depending on how large the aquifer is that they contaminate, can be much larger, because some aquifers are huge.
Well, this is in New York State. All of our aquifers are conjoined, and you contaminate it in a few places, and eventually it's going to work through every aquifer in New York State. I don't know, for your folks listening who might not understand all of the elements that are involved in hydrofracking, could I go through those?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're going to see in the commercials that the oil company puts out, you're going to see this nice little, it's going to show a field with birds and this one little kind of thing there, and it all looks clean and it all looks marvelous. Well, what they actually do is, long-line hydrofracking has only been around since about 2005. Yeah, the gas company will tell you, oh, we've been doing this for 100 years. Well, they have conventional vertical wells that went down and tapped pools of methane gas. Yes, those have been around for decades and decades. But it's only since 2005, since the long-line hydrofracking has been used. This is a very young industry, and they are going to school on us. We are the guinea pigs, while they rush off with their billions of dollars of money, of filthy lucre. For one frack of a well, it takes anywhere from 5 to 7 million gallons of fresh water. Now keep in mind that throughout our country now, fresh water is a problem, but for one frack, each long line of one of these wells, if they go for 1 to 2 miles underground, they go straight down and then they curve and they go horizontally for 1 to 2 miles. They can only frack about 500 feet per frack. So, each frack is taking 5,000 to 7,000 gallons of fresh water. Figure out how much fresh water it is taking. Now, to get it to it takes about 1,000 heavy truckloads for each one of these fracks. You're talking about tens of thousands of truck passes by your house to frack these wells, to frack just one well pad. Okay, and part of what they're putting down there are their fracking fluids, which are, the patents are owned by Halliburton. And back in 2005, Dick Cheney, who of course was one of the heads of Halliburton, got the natural gas and oil people exempted from the Clean Air, the Clean Water Acts, from every act that had been put forward to protect the American public. The oil and gas industry was totally exempted from having to pay any attention to that, so that even their trucks carrying hazardous fracking fluids do not have to say that they are hazardous. And when they are carrying the flowback that comes back up out of the wells, it is labeled as industrial waste, not even hazardous waste. So that if there's an accident, there is no way for the first responders or the people living near a spill or whatever to have any idea what it is that has been dumped on them. But what is put down there is toluene. It is ethyl glycol. It is a witch's brew of all kinds of cancer-causing chemicals, as well as other wonderful things. Then they disturb, well, they get down there, and it disturbs all the heavy metals, and what comes back up is laced with arsenic and mercury and strontium and barium and other radioactive products. And this they have to find a way to get rid of. And they take it away, not even labeled as hazardous. Okay, but now while you're on the pad, they have condensate tanks, which are pumping out ground-level ozone 24 hours a day. And don't forget that aside from the fact that this stuff, that they've got to truck this stuff away and inject it into holes in Ohio, or dump it out on your back road, as they do, they go out at night, and the back roads, they dump it into your lakes, they dump it into your rivers, poisoning your water supplies in order to get rid of it. Ah.
Wow.
And then there are the pipelines, you see. And there are pipelines that have to go from every single one of these well pads to a hub that can be up to 25 acres, where they sort out all of the byproducts that are in this stuff, that they can possibly sell some of the byproducts. And they also prepare the methane, they clean it up, so that it's suitable to go out in some of the major pipelines. But you have all of these pipelines all over the place, and they are all leaking up to 5% of their methane. Every single one of them. The methane being leaked from each one of the wellheads and from each one of the lines is major. The EPA has now said that by 2013, they have to start capturing some of this, what they call this fugitive methane, because it's being released into the atmosphere, and it's a worse greenhouse gas than CO2. People simply do not understand the truck traffic, the pipelines, the methane, and the condenser stations that pump the stuff along the pipelines, many of which have blown up down in Pennsylvania. The ground level ozone produced by this whole thing, by the truck traffic, by the condensate tanks, by the compressor stations, by the hubs, this travels up to 200 miles from its source. So everything within 200 miles of one of these major oil gas-producing places is being made to breathe ground-level ozone.
I have to confess to some ignorance here. Why would someone worry about breathing ground-level ozone?
Oh, well, it gives asthma. It gives lung cancer. It gives all kinds of wonderful things. So it's what it's smog. It's what in Los Angeles they've been trying to guard people against for 25 or 30 years now. If you live in Los Angeles, I did for 20 years, and my breathing has been seriously impaired by living in that smog for 20 years, I can tell you. Ground level ozone is deadly stuff.
Yeah, most of us assume just because it's natural, it's safe, and that's not true. I can remember
what's natural about it.
Well, if it comes
from, they call it natural gas.
Well, I think about it. You know, I made a trip a number of years ago to a hot springs in New Mexico along the Rio Grande River, and I knew when in the research that there was, you know, that they said there wasn't anything medicinal about the waters, and that they had high levels of radon, and I'd forgotten about the radon.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, radon is one of the things. Also, when you burn in your home, when you heat your home, or you cook with natural gas, you're releasing radon into your home.
Oh, well, you know, I can remember we were sitting in this hot springs, which it was a surreal, wonderful experience, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world, not even for the radon. And I looked at the friend that had made the trip with me, and I asked her, I said, you know, when I was doing the research about this hot spring, it said it was full of radon. I said, what the heck is radon? I didn't know at that time.
It's the second cause of lung cancer in the United States.
Well, it was a good thing we weren't breathing in that water then. But anyhow, we kind of looked at each other and scratched our heads and said, well, we'll have to find out when we got home. So I did research and find out radon really wasn't good for you. but like I said, it was still surreal. I mean, it was a one-time deliberate exposure to water containing radon. I figured, you know, it was worth it because it was, like I said, it was surreal. It was wonderful. We made the trip in November. So it is like right at freezing when we started from the rim of the canyon, hiked down to the springs where it's even the sun hadn't gotten to the bottom of the canyon yet. The ice cold Rio Grande is rushing by in the gorge, and that's just feet away from the hot springs. And you know, you strip off your sweatshirt and your jeans and climb into the water with your swimsuit, and it's like hot. I mean, like a hot bath.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful. The steam's rising. The sun's coming over the rim of the canyon. It was really, really surreal. And it was wonderful, and I'm glad I made that trip and did the hike and the whole business because it was wonderful. But, you know, like I said, radon may be naturally occurring in that water, but it doesn't mean that, you know, you should bottle it and sell it across the United States to drink either.
Right. Well, unfortunately, the flowback from these wells is being distributed all over the United States. Some, as I say, some into injection wells in Ohio, and where it has caused minor earthquakes. It has caused earthquakes in Ohio and in Oklahoma, Texas, England, Arkansas. And these are from injection wells, because they put the stuff down there, and included in it is like stuff that you put in soap to make it slippery.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets pushed down into these injection wells at very, very high pressures. And, you know, it gets into some of the fractures and faults that are down there, and boom, you know, it makes them slip. That's why you're getting these little earthquakes. New York State, oh my God, you should see the maps. There's a guy named Jacoby who has mapped all of the faults, the major faults and all of the fractures in New York State. It looks like the oldest person in the world with all every line that could possibly be on a human face. I mean, there are just so many of them. And the thought that this stuff is going to be shot down into that fragile underpinning of New York State, I think that it is capable of producing major earthquakes, not just small earthquakes. But, you know, that remains to be seen. At this point, the only earthquakes that it has produced has been from injection wells. Although there is one, there was one earthquake up in that they think might have been caused by hydrofracking
mm-hmm.
itself. There's another thing that has come up, and that is they talk very innocently about the sand, that they put this fresh water and sand and certain chemicals down there under very high pressure. Well, as it turns out, the sand is another killer. There is nothing about hydrofracking, basically, that won't kill you. You know, it's like Australia. In Australia, there are 100 kinds of snakes, and there's only one that won't kill you. Everything about hydrofracking turns out, you know, about the whole process, turns out to be very, very dangerous and disastrous to human and animal health and, you know, to the environment. The sand, now actually it's only found in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And Minnesota and Wisconsin are being turned into vast pits, open pit sand, to get this sand that they need for the hydrofracking. And this is a special kind of silica sand, the dust of which, when it's magnified, as a matter of fact, Gia, I think it's on page 18 of the flowback. It has the fracking sand is magnified there. There are little lasers, and they get into the lungs. This dust, when you breathe it in, it goes into the lungs, and there is no turning back. This is irremediable. Irremediable? Irremediable. Once this stuff gets into your lungs, it causes silicosis. It can be give you a lifetime breathing problems. It can even kill you. And this is a danger from the place where it's being mined in Wisconsin and Michigan to the workers who are mining it, who are loading it onto the trains, to the anybody who breathes the dust as this stuff is being transported and as it's being put into trucks and transported to the wells and as it's being put down to the wells. Anybody who is breathing this stuff is at great risk. So here, you know, that was the last thing about hydrofracking, and I thought, oh, well, sand, you know, no big problem there. Well, I'm sorry, yes, there's a great big problem with the sand. It's silica sand that is little razor-sharp things that will destroy your lungs.
Yeah. You know, and going back to the whole being active about trying to stop the hydrofracking, what can the average person do?
Well,
I mean, yes, they can read about it and do their own research, But, you know, what's next? I mean, how can you prevent fracking from coming to your neighborhood?
Well, one thing I wish that everybody in the United States would read the flowback. Everybody in the United States read the flowback, we would stop it overnight, because I've never seen anybody read the flowback and come away not saying, oh my God, now I really understand why we've got to stop this thing. But the first thing they've got to do is educate themselves. The next thing they've got to do is get to their legislators. And now in New York State we have home rule. Not all states have home rule. Home rule means that your local township, municipality, whatever, has the right to base, and there have been two court cases already in New York on that were decided in favor of the townships, that have the right to ban any of this activity within their borders. So, as I said, here in New York, we've already gotten over 140 cities and municipalities and counties and townships to ban the process.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to work in their area. They need to find out what shales might be near them, what hydrofracking activity might be planned for their area, and get to their legislators and help them understand that those legislators are not there to serve the oil and gas industry. They are there to serve the people and to protect the natural resources, the clean air, clean water, and the health of their constituents and of the environment. I'll be very happy if anybody wants to get in touch with me. I'll be very, very happy to send you information and help to guide you through whatever process might be necessary in your area. Every area is going to be different because each area has different laws and different. It also depends on how close you're going to be to any of this, and whether your aquifers can be poisoned by nearby activity. There is so much involved, but I'd be very happy to hear from anyone who wants to get in touch with me.
Yeah, and for people that have a copy of the flowback right in front of them, try and get yourself. How can you get a copy of it, Bonnie?
Get in touch with me at Bonnie@hydrorelieforg.org. That's hydrorelieforg. And we'll talk about what their situation is, how many copies they might want, how I can help in their situation, and, take it from there. But the best thing is just to email me, and we'll talk about it.
Okay, well, for, anybody who's wondering, if you have gas wells in your area, you're probably at risk. And it covers a huge portion of the United States. There's very few states that are probably being unaffected by this.
They're fracking in 34 states right now, and they're trying to get into 5 or 6 more.
In addition, many of the states that have fracking going on may be at risk for becoming a dump for the residues.
Exactly. And that's another thing. Not only, Gia, is it the liquids, but there are the cuttings, the drill cuttings from when they have to drill down thousands of feet, and then they bring up these drill cuttings. These drill cuttings are hugely radioactive. And they are, we found out that one of the things they're doing to get them out of Pennsylvania, they're mixing them with sawdust and bringing them up by the truckload and dumping them in our municipal dumps as regular dump stuff. And nobody knows that these things are highly radioactive. And unfortunately, there are towns who will take these things knowing that they're radioactive because they're offered so much money. That's why you've got to get to your local people that you have voted for, that you have put in there to protect you and to protect your children and to protect your communities, and you've got to help them understand that this entire process is deadly, and that they've got to keep it out for everyone's sake.
You know, I know a lot of communities are going to look at the idea of hydrofracking coming to their community as job creation. And in this economy, a lot of communities are pretty desperate for that job creation. So
80% of the jobs will be out of state. That they bring in their crews, the crews travel from job to job, 80% of them, they come in. And the crime rates, by the way, every place that these guys go are absolutely going through the ceiling. But 80% of the workers will come in. It's a boom bust. They run wild for a little while in your community, and then they disappear. And there are very, very few local jobs unless locals get jobs, but then they will travel on with the crews to the next job, and they'll leave the community.
So in terms of, you know, an economic boost to the community that, you might say, hosted the hydrofrackers, is there really any? I mean, do they really see any benefit?
Oh, sure. Some people are going to, the people who lease their land, they might see some royalties, depending on, you know, what kind of a lease they signed. But another thing is that the industry is promising that there might be 30 years of income here. It's finding out that most of the wells are dead after 5 years. So it's a very short-lived thing. The restaurants, motels, hotels, we'll see, you know, a lot of money there because of these wildcat crews that come in, some of them bringing their families. But unfortunately, that's another problem to the communities because they come in, they have these huge paychecks. They can pay $1,000, $1,500 a month for an apartment. And so the landlords kick out the people who are in those apartments. And what they're finding is that homelessness has become a huge problem in the communities where there is hydrofracking. I was just reading something today about what's going on in the Bakken Shale of North Carolina, or rather North Dakota. There's a terrible problem of homelessness because all of the people, all of the vulnerable people, the elderly people, the poorer people are being kicked out of their homes so that they can be rented to the oil people.
Uh-huh. Now, you know, what about expenses? I mean, isn't there an incredible amount of wear and tear on roads? Aren't these crews bringing their kids and going to school, but they don't really contribute in terms of property? Usual strain on the school systems, healthcare facilities. You know,
the Department of Transportation of New York State has called the what is going to happen ominous. They have said that on the basis of just 7,000 wells, that will probably be $222 million annually to local governments to repair the infrastructure that these trucks are going to tear up. And most places, there is no way whatsoever that it's going to be paid for any way but by the local taxpayers. It's a catastrophe.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people think, oh, jobs, and you know, increased business, blah, 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 blah. But they don't realize that there's also some expenses. And the damage to the infrastructure of the road system, the school system, the healthcare facilities, and so forth and so on. There's a lot of sort of hidden costs, you might say.
Here's a marvelous article people can look up. Folks, www.alternet.org. That's alternet.org. This is just out yesterday. The article is "The North Dakota Oil Fracking Boom Creates Clash of Money and Devastation." It's an excellent article which will give you a really good idea of what happens to communities when hydrofracking comes in. That's "The North Dakota Oil Fracking Boom Creates Clash of Money and Devastation" at alternet.org.
And then when contamination does occur, mm-hmm. are these oil companies being held accountable?
No. No. Down in Vania, I mean, it just absolutely makes you cry. There have been 3,000 violations just this year. And there have been like a few hundred dollars in fines levied on these companies. They're given a slap on the wrist and, you know, sent on their merry way, you know, go forth, my child, and sin no more. But, of course, they do. Everybody is paid off, Gia. Everybody is paid off.
Well, you know, I've heard a lot about this. You know, the running joke that I've seen often on Facebook has been about how our politicians should wear jumpsuits with their corporate sponsors and signals on. when you start actually looking at which politicians, especially at the national level, have had considerable sized contributions from various oil companies to their campaigns, it becomes pretty frightening because it's almost all of them.
Well, both the Republican and Democratic conventions were paid for by the oil companies. And that tells you where we stand.
And, you know, with this recent business about corporations being people too, I just really have a hard time with this because, you know, as a person, I have legal responsibilities to include the right to vote. You know, if I was young enough and I could be drafted, if I was young and healthy enough, I could go into the service and be asked to die for the country. I've yet to see a corporation be able to do those things.
No, they just reap the profits from people going into
and they never
the
die.
Wars and dying.
And they never die. I mean, literally,
no.
They never die.
Right.
So, you know, there are some issues here. And a lot of people are saying, whoa, this is wrong. And it's really kind of wrong to think of the power that apparently the oil industry has managed to grasp politically and legally in the United States.
Well, you know, Gio, I'd like to bring this back to the Magdalene because I was thinking earlier that one of the things that Josh in the Magdalene is a stickler for is telling the truth. It's the truth. And our civilization or our country, our way of life has gotten so far away from the truth. We are so afraid to tell the truth, to recognize the truth, and to go with the truth when we find it. And that's the only way, I mean, that the truth will set us free. It's the only way that we will become free is to have the courage, each one of us, in our own lives, to see the truth, to speak seek the truth and just to demand the truth of the society around us.
Yeah. We are running out of time. Bonnie, you want to tell people where they can get their own copy of the Flowback, as well as if they would like to make a contribution to your organization?
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, contributions to the Flowback, I'll let people know if they get in touch with me, but they are tax deductible.
Okay.
If anybody wants to make a contribution, you can get me at bonnie@hydrorelief.org. As far as my books are concerned, my website is bonniejonesreynolds.com. And if they want to find out about Spring Farm Cares, they just get onto our website, which is springfarmcares.org.
Great. Well, folks, I hope that tonight has been as enjoyable to you as it has been for me. Bonnie, I want to thank you very much for coming on tonight.
Oh, I love it. Thank you.
And unfortunately, we have run out of time all too quickly once again. And I hope that tonight's program has given everyone plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next time as another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.